Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When I'm at the beach, I always feel like the ocean has this rejuvenating effect on me. Not in the sense that my wrinkles smooth out, but in the sense of this boundless joy you feel when you're a kid.
The water is touching my toes. Here it comes. Woo!
I was watching the sun come up in Vero Beach, Florida on that day, smelling the salt water, listening to the sounds of the waves. Pelicans were flying overhead.
It's just before 7 o'clock in the morning, and the whole horizon is this beautiful shade of pink, I guess, orange.
To my kids, the ocean is an endless source of fun and exploration.
What's that?
Piece of coral.
Yeah.
It has wormholes in it.
I know.
Not like earthworms, but like sea worms.
And I'm feeling pretty zen.
It makes you feel like life goes on. Because the ocean's been here forever and the waves keep coming, so it sort of gives you this sense of peace and eternity.
Scientists who study the ocean probably feel all of that too, but they are looking at things differently.
I'm working in the Southern Ocean to study penguins.
Like Jean-Baptiste Thiebaud.
When I look at the ocean, I see a space of wilderness, one of the last ones that we really, really need to protect. Something very important for all of us.
Or Samantha Chapman. She studies mangroves and the thin green line of vegetation that exists between land and sea.
So I spend a lot of time trudging around in the mud of marshes and mangroves. When I look at the ocean, I see first a place to wash off all the mud on my pants and shoes. But second, I see the water and microscopic organisms that nourish these beautiful coastal ecosystems that protect us from big storms that, ironically, start in the ocean.
Our lives are connected to the ocean in so many ways. We need it to survive. But our presence and habits pose a threat to the ocean's ecosystems. On today's episode, the ocean and us.
When I look out at the ocean, what I see is life and the universe itself.
We owe a lot to the sea. It gives us food to eat, water to drink, and oxygen in the air that we breathe. In return, we're not always very appreciative. Nowadays, our impact on the ocean, our marine footprint, is bigger than it's ever been. Steph Yin looked into one way our presence in the sea has majorly increased.
Will West is in a part of the world most of us can't even fathom visiting.
So hello from 359 feet in the Indian Ocean, off the island of Poivre.
Poivre is in the Seychelles, off the coast of East Africa, and Will is 359 feet below the sea's surface, in a deep-sea submersible. He's with a team of scientists who are on a mission to demystify the ocean's twilight zone, beyond the reach of the sun's rays. It's toward the end of their dive, and they've just come across a rich habitat.
Some larger fish, lots of urchins, a larger shark came darting by too quickly for us to tell what type it was.
The mission is led by the Necton Oxford Deep Ocean Research Institute, based in England.
We're going to be ascending soon. We've been down for over 2.5, nearly 3 hours now, so it's time to come back, although the sub can last down here for much, much longer. We need to get back on deck before it's dark.
One of the things Will's team is here to study is plastics. Specifically, tiny pieces of plastic practically invisible to the naked eye, called microplastics. In the past decade or so, scientists have started finding plastics and microplastics all over the ocean. When we think of plastic in the ocean, we tend to think of it floating on the surface. Maybe you've heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch and envision an island-sized carpet of trash floating in the middle of the sea, but
that's just the the literal scratch on the surface, right?
That's Randy Rogin, a research assistant professor at Boston University.
I mean, plastic is a complicated topic because there's what you see, and everyone, I think, envisions plastic trash or styrofoam or cups, but all of that breaks down into really, really small particles.
Randy works in the Phoenix Islands, in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. She says microplastics are suspended all throughout the water column and buried in the seafloor, too. It's more like flecks of spice and seasoning distributed throughout a bowl of soup than spots of fat you can skim off the surface. Randy spends a lot of her time studying plastics, but she doesn't particularly want to be a plastics researcher.
I don't really have a choice. Plastic just keeps showing up in all of our samples. Every sample we've looked at in any ecosystem that we've looked at across the globe, plastic has been part of the story, and it's been impossible to ignore.
To get to the Phoenix Islands protected area where Randy works, you have to travel 7 days by boat from Hawaii. Even there, in a protected area, in one of the most remote places on Earth, scientists find plastics enmeshed in samples they take from the sea surface.
And those are all typically microplastics that are floating in a place that's so far away that the closest people to us when we're out there are on the International Space Station. It's pretty scary.
Randy and other researchers are starting to suspect that there's no part of the ocean left untouched by plastic. Recently, a study found for the first time that tiny deep-sea creatures living in the Pacific's Mariana Trench are eating staggering amounts of plastic.
It's terrifying because Mariana Trench is the deepest part of our planet.
The Mariana Trench is 36,000 feet below sea level. It's a zone where the ocean floor is sinking into the interior of the Earth, going deeper and deeper until it melts. If you were to take Mount Everest and drop it in the deepest part of the trench, you'd still have more than a mile of water above it. Even in that abyss, there's life. Specifically, little shrimp-like creatures called amphipods, about the size of the pull tab on a soda can. The researchers found plastic in the guts of over 70% of the amphipods they collected. They also found high levels of toxins called PCBs in the amphipods' bodies. Randy walked me through how scientists go about collecting tiny deep-sea creatures. Typically, they use a remotely operated vehicle, or if they're lucky, a manned submersible.
They have suction samplers, which are kind of like little vacuums, which will suction up sediment and then deposit that sediment into some kind of jar or box that will then be brought up to the surface.
On the surface, scientists do delicate dissections under the microscope, like a very fine-tuned autopsy. In the guts they crack open, they find microplastics of all types. Perfectly round beads, thin pointy fibers, odd-shaped miscellanea. There's red, blue, green, purple, pink, like bits of a kaleidoscope.
They're very colorful, and I normally love, rainbows in the sky, but not rainbows in the guts of organisms.
Then scientists analyze each sample's molecular structure to figure out specifically what type of plastic they're looking at. That helps them guess where the plastic might have come from. Say it's a polyamide. That might be from nylon rope used on boats. Cellulose acetate, likely from a cigarette butt. I wanted to understand the bigger picture of where all this plastic comes from and how it ends up in the deep sea. So I called up Emily Penn. She's the founder of X Expedition, a group that runs all women sailing voyages around the world to raise awareness about plastic pollution.
So 8 million tons of plastic leave land down drains, streams, rivers, and waterways flowing into the ocean. And that's every year.
Just to give you a sense, that's equal to dumping a garbage truck full of plastic into the ocean every minute. There are many ways plastic ends up there. Many countries dump their garbage directly into the ocean. And in countries with trash collection, plastic escapes on its way to and at the landfill, then flows downstream. You might say, okay, well, I'm a diligent recycler. But the truth is, globally, only 9% of plastic is recycled. All that garbage is considered macroplastic. Macroplastic ends up in the ocean, gets worn down by the sun's UV rays, waves, and wind action, and eventually becomes microplastics. There are also a couple big direct sources of microplastics. One is, as your car tires wear down, little fibers come off and go down storm drains. The other is the fibers that come off synthetic fabrics we wash in our washing machines. Think of all the stuff in your dryer lint draining into the ocean. The twist is, researchers have only found a tiny fraction of the plastic that leaves land on the ocean's surface. So the big question is, where is the rest of it?
What we expect is happening is that it's actually sinking, particularly when it gets out to these deep parts of the world. And it gets coated in algae, it gets barnacles that grow on it, and then that makes that plastic heavier than water, and it sinks to the bottom.
It sinks further and further down, and that's how plastic gets in places like the Mariana Trench and ends up in our deep-sea friends, the amphipods. Randy, the marine ecologist, says plastic in these little guys' guts is a big deal.
It has the potential to crash food webs, right? If organisms aren't getting the nutrition that they need because their bellies are full, but they have no nutrition because they're full of microplastics instead of food, I mean, that just doesn't bode well for the continuation of healthy marine ecosystems.
And those microplastics come back to us. After all, we're at the top of those food webs.
I am from Saipan, which is the largest island in the Northern Mariana Islands.
That's Angelo Villagomez. He has a lot of firsthand experience with the ocean and seafood.
When I was growing up, I could go down to the beach, look out to the ocean, and we will say, well, that's the deepest water in the world. The Mariana Trench is right out there.
For Angelo, plastic and PCB pollution in the Mariana Trench isn't some abstract problem.
You know, I don't think of it as this far-off place. I think of it as there's plastic and pollution in my backyard. And, you know, this is the backyard where we're catching our dinner. That's where we got most of our food.
Angelo's relationship with the ocean started early. As a kid, he was always outside, surrounded by the sea. It was also a big part of his culture.
I'm an indigenous Chamorro. My family is very proud to be Chamorro. You know, it affects all aspects of our life, from politics to what we eat and how we live.
The Chamorro are the native inhabitants of the Mariana Islands, and fishing is woven into their way of life. Angelo started fishing with his father when he was 8.
Those were my earliest lessons in conservation. I can remember coconut crab hunting late at night, and we came across a crab, and it was covered in eggs. And I can remember my father saying, no, we don't touch the coconut crab when it has eggs, because if we take that crab, your kids won't have crabs when it's their turn to go coconut crab hunting.
Angelo says the fact that plastics are entering wild food chains particularly affects indigenous communities.
Indigenous people, as a whole, our diets consist of wild animals more than other folks. So if these poisons are leaching into the food that we're eating, those poisons are then leaching into us.
Today, Angelo works for the Pew Bertarelli Ocean Legacy Project, which fights for the creation of marine protected areas. He says plastics are just one threat marine environments are facing.
And Steph, Angelo just used the word poison. Are we all being poisoned by plastic in the ocean? What do we know about the health impact of this plastic?
So plastic does have toxic compounds in it, things like PCBs, BPA, phthalates. Those have been linked to cancer and hormone disruptions. And plastic is also probably absorbing other chemicals in the ocean, like pesticides. The thing is, we're not directly eating physical bits of plastic that often because we're not actually eating the stomachs of fish. But what might be happening is that the poisons are leaching from the guts of these animals into the rest of their body and traveling up the food web.
I think a lot of people are concerned about these issues, both from a health perspective, but also, of course, from the perspective of the health of the ocean. So what are some things that could be done to reduce our footprint and all of this plastic?
Yeah, so I mean, the first thing is that we just heard that most of this plastic might be in the seafloor. And so cleanup isn't really an option. It's not like we can take a big vacuum to the seafloor. So that leaves us with reducing the amount of plastic we're using on land. And that's going to have to be a multi-pronged effort because it's such a big problem. So advocates say, you know, the big polluters in industry have a big responsibility to reduce their footprint and look for new materials like compostable plastics. Governments need to support those shifts and also incentivize more recycling through maybe standardizing the plastic we can recycle to the few bits that are best to recycle. And then on a consumer level, people like you and I, we can reduce our plastic and particularly reduce single-use plastic use. So that is the one cup of coffee, you get it and you throw it away after an hour, because plastic is really designed to last forever. So it's not meant to be this temporary one-use thing.
No more iced coffee.
Bring a tumbler.
Yes. Thank you, Steph.
Thanks, Mikan.
We're talking about oceans and how our impact is changing them. Some scientists say jellyfish populations are increasing. That has led to beach closures all over the world and even deaths in Australia and the Philippines. Giselle Regatao reports on new research on these mysterious creatures.
Coney Island is a popular beach spot for New Yorkers like the Seaman family. A couple of summers ago, Alan, who's 12, noticed something different.
It was a hot day, and you can see jellyfish on the sand outside the water. There were a lot of them.
Alan and his dad, Michael, got into the water anyway.
They're not going to scare me of swimming, because I like swimming.
They both got stung.
It was painful. It was scratchy.
Did you leave the water right away?
Yeah, in a panic.
Alan's mom, Lena, says the water seems warmer lately.
For kids, it's enjoyable, but in reality, we don't know how it's affect globally everybody.
Biologist Stefania Rodriguez suspects that a warmer ocean has allowed some jellyfish populations to reproduce more.
I do believe that they are growing and that, yeah, it's mainly because of us.
Stefania works at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Besides global warming, she says overfishing has helped boost jellyfish numbers.
Fishes eat them, so if you don't have the fishes, then they don't have predators. And it's a change that goes and grows.
For us, that growth means more interactions with jellyfish, more stings, and an occasionally ruined summer holidays when jellyfish blooms close down beaches. There are more than 2,000 species of jellyfish, and some of them are very dangerous. For example, the box jellyfish carries a venom that can kill a person in 5 minutes. The growth in the jellyfish population has sparked more interest in studying them.
Jellyfish go back over 500 million years.
That's David Gruber, a professor of biology at Baruch College in New York.
Homo sapiens only go back a couple hundred thousand years. So jellyfish have been around for much, much longer than us. They have survived all of the five previous massive extinction events.
David is also a National Geographic explorer, and he's writing a book about jellyfish. He says scientists now believe that they are a big part of the ocean's food chain. We've known that when whales die and fall to the bottom of the sea, they can feed deep-sea animals for months.
But now what we're learning is that jellyfish falls, smaller intermittent ones, this little gelatinous meals, are possibly equally as important in maintaining deep-sea biodiversity as whale falls.
2 years ago, he began experiments using an underwater robot to study jellyfish.
To us, is a gentle, soft robotic way of learning more than we might have learned by actually grabbing the animal and bringing it up to the surface and putting it in a jar.
The big advantage is being able to observe the animal in its own environment. Mechanical engineer ZRNTO designed the plastic robot. He says he was inspired by paper origami he grew up making in his native Singapore.
So that sheet of paper is flat. And from flat, you can get fantastical 3D shapes.
The robot also starts as a flat surface with 12 faces. Then a motor triggers the faces to fold, forming a ball the size of a watermelon. And the jellyfish gets scooped inside that bubble. Z says observing them with the robot made him lose his fear.
And most of the time when you go close to them, they kind of sting you, and so you kind of shy away from them. But being up close and seeing them with different lights and how some of them can bioluminesce really took my breath away.
Biologist David Gruber says the next step in his research is to have the robot do a 3D scan and a DNA swab of the jellyfish. David wants to understand how the animals are able to survive their changing environment, but he's worried even the very resilient jellyfish might suffer considering how different the sea is becoming.
I do see dramatic changes in the ocean. My philosophy is that everybody in the ocean is getting harmed by an unhealthy ocean. Nobody wants to live in a sick, fetid, warm, acidic ocean, including jellyfish.
That story was reported by Giselle Regatao. We're talking about oceans and exploring how our presence impacts life underwater. Rick Stafford is a marine biologist at Bournemouth University in southwest England along the Jurassic Coast, and he's interested in one particular threat marine organisms face, noise.
You can't really get away from noise anywhere on land in the UK, but if your head's underwater, if there's no boats going past, it's a very natural sort of soundscape. It's not silent. There's lots of sounds. So obviously, when you're above the ocean, you're hearing waves crashing, you're maybe hearing water flowing, wind over the water, that sort of noise. As soon as you put your head under, it's completely different. It's as close as you can get to being in a completely different world. There's nothing in the sea which is quite like on land. So it's not completely silent, but it's completely natural. All you actually do have to do is to shove your head under the water. Coral reefs have a certain sort of clicking, almost like popping noise, which most of the time actually comes from snapper shrimp, just sort of moving their pinchers. So it's quite a distinctive noise. And in fact, different coral reefs sound different from each other. You probably wouldn't pick that up as a human, but lots of fish, for example, can. You can see that there's a tendency for fish to reproduce. They then have a pelagic phase out in the water, and then they'll try to come back to coral reefs. They appear to be able to pick up on the sound of their home reef, the smell as well, but also the sound, and be able to move back towards that. There is communication underwater as well. I guess the reason you don't think about it is fish don't have ears. They have something called a lateral line, which will pick up on sound, picks up vibration in a similar sort of way, but some marine mammals will have ears. They certainly use sound to communicate. Things like boat noise or other sort of man-made underwater noise can disrupt some of those communications. But it will prevent them from hearing each other. I guess it's sort of similar to if you go to a pub or a nightclub or something which is loud and you just can't hear what people are saying. The other thing, I guess, is something like big shipping lanes where you have a lot of boats moving through at the same time, so you've got persistent noise. They are surprisingly noisy. Again, just from diving the other week, there was a boat came up with its propeller running and it's all you can hear. It's like a really very loud noise in your head. I guess there's an overall sort of stress level. You know, you're not used to hearing those noises, and if they're constantly there, same way as if a car alarm's going off or something outside, if it keeps going on, it's going to annoy you eventually.
That was marine biologist Rick Stafford from Bournemouth University in southwest England. Laura Irving produced this piece. Seaweed farming, specifically growing kelp, is having a bit of a moment right now.
Kelp is the new kale.
You know what? Kelp is the new kale.
They make kelp the new kale.
And really, kelp is the new kale.
Kelp is the new kale.
Seaweed fans say it can nourish us while also reducing the effects of climate change. Can kelp save the day? Alan Yu checked it out.
Rob Busher is making lunch in his apartment. That involves several different types of seaweed.
You know, I grew up eating Japanese food. My great-grandparents immigrated from Japan in the 1920s.
He rinses some dark green bits of hijiki seaweed for a salad. He puts slices of wakame seaweed into a miso soup. And he cuts strips of dried crisp seaweed on top of cold soba noodles.
All right, and we're good to go.
Seaweed is a major part of Japanese cuisine. The varieties that Rob uses are imported from Japan. But seaweed farmers in the US want to grow more of it here, and they say it should be a bigger part of our diets. Earlier this year, I got on a boat to check it out. I went to a Thimble Island ocean farm off the coast of Connecticut. They grow seaweed and oysters.
Who gets to go boating in January on Long Island Sound except for us? Who is that lucky?
Ron Goutreau is giving me a tour. His official title is Senior Farmer Trainer. He's been tending to this underwater farm for years. They lease a swath of ocean from the town. On the surface, all you see are buoys and ropes.
This is an obstacle course of ropes and things to get your propeller caught in.
He cranks a handle, lifting a rope out of the water, and you see a green curtain of kelp hanging down. Kelp looks a little bit like green lasagna noodles with curly edges. Farm manager Jill Pagnatero explains it pretty much grows by itself. No fertilizer or human input needed. She says all you need is a boat, 20 acres, and $20,000.
That in itself makes it accessible for people to be able to do. It's much less expensive than trying to start a land farm.
The seaweed takes nutrients like nitrogen compounds from the water, effectively cleaning the ocean. It soaks up carbon dioxide, which slows down climate change. The seaweed is food for humans and also home for shrimp and tiny fish. We pull one up with the rest of the haul.
This is a tautog, right?
Yeah. Oh, is it still alive? Or?
Yeah. Do you know
oh,
what?
It's jumping.
It's wiggling in my hands.
The seaweed also grows alongside scallops and oysters.
So that's a bunch of oysters at a harvest size in a bag.
For an extra bonus, the oysters and seaweed can absorb some of the energy from storm surges and protect people living along the coast. That'll become more of a problem as sea levels rise. This farm is also a floating classroom for farmers who want to get into the seaweed business. And there's a lot of interest in this. Back on land, I catch up with Bren Smith.
The momentum's been unbelievable. Again, we have requests to start farms in every coastal state in North America, 20 countries around the world.
He's one of the founders of this farm and a leading advocate for this kind of farming, where it's a win-win for humans and the ocean. Bren calls it restorative ocean farming and has done a lot of work to spread the word about it. He formed a nonprofit called Green Wave to promote restorative ocean farming. Now there are farms in Connecticut, Maine, and Massachusetts.
We're growing and people are eating it, and this isn't like a cute little Brooklyn bee farm project, right? Creating little nice little bottles of honey at the farmer's market. Like there are hundreds of thousands of pounds being produced and sold at this point.
In fact, growing seaweed has become perhaps too popular.
The idea sort of took off before all the practical challenges can be addressed.
That's Anushka Concepcion, an assistant extension educator with the Connecticut Sea Grant. Basically, she works with seafood producers and researchers and answers questions about the latest technology and trends. She says growing seaweed is a great idea. It's cheap, slows climate change, feeds people, but the problem is we need more people to buy it.
Farmers are finding it difficult now just to get rid of their seaweed. They can't get rid of it.
She says usually the seafood business works like this. Oysters and clams are sold right off a boat to a dealer who sells them to restaurants.
Dealers are not buying seaweed yet because there's no established market on their end.
I tried the kelp. It's a little chewy when it's raw and fresh off the line. It can be used as a pasta substitute, sautéed with butter and mushrooms, or ground into powder to use as seasoning. But it's just not a mainstream food yet. And there's another problem, processing facilities. Here's Bren Smith again.
Kelp, for example, which only has a shelf life of like a half hour, and getting it out of the water and blanched within very quickly to stabilize it, and that's just expensive.
It's fine to do this on a small scale, but once you get more and more farmers growing kelp, you need big buildings with giant tubs of hot water and freezers to process it and keep it safe to eat. Bren says Connecticut doesn't have those yet, so if a lot more people start growing more seaweed, that's a problem. Maine does have some of that infrastructure built out just because they have a longer history of harvesting seaweed. Bren is one of the biggest seaweed advocates in the US, and even he acknowledges it's time to deal with growing pains.
in a way, expectations have been set way too high. This is an exciting, scalable, replicable thing that can be a true climate solution, but it's going to be really hard work.
He does disagree with Anoushka slightly.
So it's not about growing sort of slow and small, because we only have 30 years to address the climate crisis, right? That would have been great in the 1950s.
He says climate change is such a big issue, and to make this a reality, we need all hands on deck.
That means mobilizing massive amounts of capital. It means developing new skills underwater. It means, like, you know, developing a new generation of ocean farming scientists and economists and policymakers.
And people have to develop an appetite for kelp. Brent says quite a lot of farmers have gotten the taste for kelp, but they need chefs and consumers to catch on.
That was Alan Yu reporting. Seaweed may not be that high in demand just yet, but our appetites for seafood sure are growing. Global consumption has doubled over the last 50 years. Aquaculture, where farmers dig pools or stake out parts of the ocean to breed fish and shellfish in captivity, is one way to keep salmon and tilapia on store shelves. But conservationists have long been skeptical about the practice and whether it's really a solution to overfishing or making matters even worse. Ellen Horn was one of those skeptics. In fact, observing aquaculture practices in Thailand filled her with so much dread, she quit the field of conservation altogether. She told us what happened.
Okay, the noise of the shrimp farm being aerated.
I made this recording 15 years ago at a shrimp farm near Phuket, Thailand. I will never forget the stench of a shrimp farm and the dead shrimp floating on top. I've been to another shrimp farm and it smelled the same. That other time, I met this shrimp farmer. He told us a guy near the airport hooked him up with a shrimp farm kit. And so he dug up a pool, and the first year he made some money, but not enough to pay the guy back. And now look at it. No matter how many antibiotics he added or how much air he pumped through, the shrimp died. New plan, he's going to dig up another area and start over, because he still owes money to the guy by the airport. And he's going to need more antibiotics. The kicker, the place he's digging up, it's a mangrove forest.
Within the mangroves are many different species of crabs.
My friend, Duncan McCrae, a marine biologist, walks us out along a path through the trees with this crazy-looking root system, long fingers poking into the mud. You can hear the boat engines on the seas, so close to us. In only a few feet, the mud becomes sea. I can see tons of boats just beyond that in open water. Mangrove forest sequesters more carbon than any other kind of forest. Today, more than half of the world's mangroves have been cleared out to make way for shrimp farms. And healthy mangroves are essential for coral reefs. Coral reefs occupy less than 1% of the ocean floor, but they contain a quarter of all marine life, making them the most biodiverse place on the planet, many scientists think. For coral reefs, there is so much bad news. Warming seas, the acidification of the oceans, dissolved carbon dioxide is literally turning reefs to rubble. And add to that shrimp farming? For me, that represented utter despair. I couldn't imagine what we could do to address this death spiral of killing mangroves and flooding the waters with antibiotics. The more I learned, the more hopeless I felt. And that day, looking at those dying shrimp, it seemed like conservation efforts were futile. These shrimp farmers were just people trying to make a living with aquaculture. And in trying to farm the sea, here they are accelerating its destruction. And oh, that antibiotic cherry on top. That trip to Thailand was the end for me. I left conservation and became a radio producer. But lately, I've been hearing from a friend from high school about some new efforts to get smarter fast in the ocean. And today, with so much terrifying news about climate change, what I'm hearing about aquaculture is so full of hope and potential. It's changed how I feel about what's possible. I've started to think that aquaculture might have a role in conservation after all.
That's Ellen Horn. She was the executive producer of Radiolab, and she's now launched a new production company, Story Mechanics. And we reached out to that friend Ellen mentioned. Her name is Amy Novogratz. She co-founded AquaSpark, which invests in sustainable aquaculture. Amy told me about 10 years ago, she didn't have a clue about farming fish. She knew conservationists were pushing back against the practice, but then she started hearing a different message.
Look, you've been boo-hooing aquaculture. You've been saying it's a bad thing. Well, you need to know that aquaculture is going to develop one way or another. So the smartest thing you could do is get involved in how it develops.
Amy says aquaculture could be a great way to decrease overfishing and to feed the Earth's growing population, when done right. One of the big issues is how to feed the farmed fish.
That isn't taking away from humans, isn't using a lot of land, water, isn't wild-caught fish, is kind of one of the big challenges. So feed ingredients are a big priority for us. We're investing in things like microbes, insects, and also to plant-based feed ingredients.
So you would use insects or something else that's relatively easy to grow to feed to fish, which then we can eat.
Easy to grow and needs a lot less resources to grow.
Amy says companies are also developing different ways to replace antibiotics or use less of them, for example, by reducing overcrowding on fish farms. If we got a better handle on aquaculture and if there was more sustainable aquaculture, how could that impact our oceans overall?
I mean, I don't think people realize aquaculture is already bigger than wild-caught fish when it comes to human consumption. We consume more fish from aquaculture than we do from the ocean. Two-thirds of our population are dependent on the ocean for their major source of protein. We're taking a lot of fish out of the ocean, and aquaculture is growing. We need to triple it by 2050 to keep up with demand. So getting it right, making it more efficient as this ideal source of producing animal protein, it saves us in a lot of ways.
That's Amy Novogratz. She's the co-founder of AquaSpark. It's a company that invests in sustainable aquaculture. They are based in the Netherlands. Coming up, the healing power of the ocean.
She stepped out of the ocean and she sounded like a different person. She sounded like a perfectly healthy person.
That's next on The Pulse. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about our relationship with the ocean. So far, we've mostly heard about how our footprint is changing life in the sea. The ocean is tied in so many big ways to our survival as a species. But beyond that, for many of us, it feels like a healing place.
Let's go, Helen. Let's go.
This is my favorite day of the year.
I got my inner mermaid on. It's a feeling that you never feel before if you're not disabled.
Did you catch a wave?
Lots of them. A big one, too.
These happy sounds are from an annual event at the New Jersey Shore called They Will Surf Again, where volunteers help people with disabilities catch some waves. Randy Scott Carroll met one of the surfers, Jack Cavanaugh.
Jack suffered a brain injury in college and says before days like today, life was a bit monotonous. Then his physical therapist encouraged him to give surfing a try.
She's like, Jack, you're doing this. And I was like, I don't know. It's like I can barely like walk as it is. So now they're going to tell me to just swim.
Jack has surfed here the last 4 years, and he's made quite a name for himself. His first year, he came in a wheelchair. But by his second year, he said he would walk to the event, and he did. The next year, he got up on his knees on the surfboard.
And it's like so much freedom, you can't even describe it. And this like gave me just a little taste of it again.
After years of therapy, Jack can now walk around without too much help. And as his turn came up to surf, he quietly mentioned to me that he might try standing up on the board. So I gathered around with a few other folks who were there to support him.
Did Jack tell you he was going to try to stand up today?
No. Oh, no.
That's what he told me.
Oh, my goodness.
I was like, "Who? Did you tell people that?" He's like, "I don't know. I might do it. I might not. I think I'm going to." He's like, "I'm going to try." I was like, "All right."
Jack is amazing. He's a trip.
Before we know it, yeah. Jack's riding a wave. And all of a sudden, he stands up.
That was great.
I was not expecting that.
Oh my God.
Attaboy!
That was Randy Scott Carroll reporting at the New Jersey Shore. We're talking about our relationship with the ocean and its healing powers.
Since I learned how to dive under the waves and listen to the humpbacks, I've spent my life in the ocean and in the outdoors. It makes me live better and longer.
That's the voice of Mallory Smith. She documented her struggles with cystic fibrosis.
It's 2014 in Stanford, California. My lung function is 40%.
Now big breath in. Blow! Blow, 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 blow. Good, keep blowing. Just a little more, just a little more. Breath in deep. Good.
Water.
Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease. It causes mucus to build up in the lungs and in other organs. It's progressive and has no cure.
CF isn't a disease that you can forget about until you get sick. It's the kind of disease you're fighting every minute of every day. Its armies gain on me with each passing year, with the quantity and severity of complications snowballing as I get older.
Mallory spent so much of her life being sick and in hospitals, but Mallory didn't let that stop her. She was a straight-A student, she graduated from Stanford, she worked in audio journalism, she had tons of friends, she played sports, and the ocean was always therapy for her, in more ways than one. Here's her mother, Diane Shader-Smith.
When she was 3, 4, and 5 and she was diagnosed and we were just solely focused on keeping her healthy, we noticed that when we went to Hawaii for that week or 10 days, that her symptoms were much less severe. It was very dramatically noticeable and everybody in the family noticed it. So we came back, we talked to the doctors about it and they didn't really have an explanation. But shortly after that, sometime in Mallory's childhood, they found through a study that the kids in Australia who surfed with cystic fibrosis did better than any other population of kids with CF. So we decided, okay, gave her as much access to salt water as we could, and then pushed her into swimming and water polo when none of her friends were doing that because we knew that the swimming was equally as important. And she fell in love with it. She loved swimming, she loved water polo, she loved the ocean. And then when she came to understand the benefits of surfing, she tried it, and at that point she was obsessed and started surfing and surfed for the last years of her life.
And what is the thinking behind surfing being beneficial?
So one of the treatments, there are two treatments that kids do now routinely. One is inhaling hypertonic saline through a nebulizer, and the other one is using a nasal sinus rinse that has a salt in it, hypertonic saline in there. Because the unsophisticated, non-medical way to describe it is to say that salt helps thin the mucus. And so when she would go in the ocean, she would tell me, "Mom, I would cough up all this mucus that had been lodged there." And the reason surfing, as opposed to just standing in the ocean, is the pounding of the waves, that would dislodge the mucus. And then the thinning of it from the salt water would help her bring it up. So she would bring up what was in her chest, and whatever was lodged in her sinus would always come out. And she stepped out of the ocean, and she sounded like a different person, sounded like a perfectly healthy person.
In September of 2017, Mallory had a lung transplant, but a superbug that had plagued her before the transplant resurfaced, and it overwhelmed her lungs and her entire system. She died 3 weeks later. She was 25 years old. After Mallory's death, Diane started reading her daughter's journal, thousands of pages. Mallory wrote about everything from her deepest fears to her life philosophy to being happy despite her disease.
It was the single most incredible gift a grieving mother could get.
Diane works in publishing. She edited Mallory's journal and published parts of it posthumously in a memoir called Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life. It seems like Mallory also had a very spiritual connection to the ocean, and she wrote about that.
Mallory loved the ocean, and sometimes when we would fight or she would be upset about something, she would run into the ocean, and this was usually in the summer when we were staying near the beach or on a trip, and she would go in the ocean to cry. And I didn't know it, but she told me later, she said, the only place I feel really comfortable crying is in the ocean. And she also was not somebody who wanted people to see her vulnerable, sad, depressed, scared, anxious side. She had made this decision to live happy and show the world that side of her personality because she just didn't want to burden people with her disease and the ramifications of it. That's what she used her journal for, and that's what the book came from. But she did have a moment in, I think it was 2014, that is worth discussing because she had been seriously ill and spent a lot of time in the hospital and lost what we like to call her mojo. And going into the ocean helped her heal herself spiritually and physically.
Okay. So let's read from that passage.
Okay. I felt helpless and vulnerable and broken. I started to crumble underwater, and the salty tears were mingling with the salt water of the ocean, and I was completely alone. But then I wasn't. I had exhaled all of my breath, so I could sink down below the surface a bit, and I was lying face up, looking at the sky through the water, and all of a sudden something appeared in my right field of vision. This Hanu, this green seed turtle, swam up, and it got really close to me and just sort of stopped and hung there and stayed close. And I was probably imagining this, but it felt like it was looking at me, not just looking at me, but really seeing me. And I looked back at this creature with its brown shell and cracked skin and large dark eyes and thought to myself that it had come along at that moment for a reason. I'm not a spiritual person, but I had an epiphany that that one seed turtle helped set me on the path to feeling whole again.
Diane Shader-Smith edited and published her daughter Mallory's memoir. It's called Salt in My Soul, An Unfinished Life.
It didn't really matter. Whatever she was doing in the ocean, she was always at her happiest.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Andreas Copes is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.